Welcome to the Labor Beat Radio program on Enlightened Radio. And you can always access us at www.enlightenradio.org. And in case your cell phone, sometimes the player does not always appear on the top of the www.enlightenradio.org on your phone. So in case you have a problem finding it there, you can go to player.enlightenradio.org. And the podcast from most of our broadcasts here are accessible two places. One is on podcasts.enlightenradio.org, and the other is on democracyroad.podbean.com. On today's show, it's appearing at our new time here at 10 a.m., but we will podcast it usually by the end of the day. Onto podcast.enlightenradio.org. But today, mainly due to the fact that former Senator John Unger, Pastor John Unger, had invited us to participate a couple of weeks ago in a Appalachian labor section of a course, apparently, that he's teaching at Shepherd University. And it sort of inspired because we're in a season of significantly increased labor agitation across the country and expressing itself in a lot of different ways. And of course, the Appalachian economies are unique in some ways in the country and have a lengthy history that obviously impacts the ability of the states that are involved or the communities that are involved, how they're supposed to deal with working for a living. And so I'm very happy today that our friend, longtime friend on this program and its various incarnations, John Unger, has agreed to join us today. And I'm glad that he's teaching a course at Shepherd. I think it's, anyone that gets out of the political scene and has been as involved as John has in our community and our state, the experiences and mainly just experiences from so many more different sources than a lot of people in their ordinary lives come into contact with, more diverse sources. And I think the perspectives that you can get from that and then apply them, see how they reproduce in succeeding generations. It's a fascinating thing that is something that we would stay tuned to. I think we can learn a lot about the people we're living with and where we're going and where we came from. So I want to thank John for joining us today. And I guess my first question is, can you lay out a little bit what got you involved in this course and what your questions are that lead you to explore Appalachian labor as an important part. So I'm going to hope you open for it, and we're going to, John and I will we'll test you at various points if we can. Anyway, thank you so much.
Well, good morning. Good morning, John, JB. It's good to be with you all again, and it's good to join you. Once I got out of elected politics, I consider myself a recovering politician. I wanted to really get into teaching. And so I'm a professor at Blue Ridge Community Technical College, as well as adjunct professor at Shepherd University. And I was approached by Dr. Sherbet, who's heads up the Appalachian Studies program at Shepherd University, and asked to teach a course. And she said that they have an excellent Appalachian Studies program there that actually many years ago, Dr. Sherbet and I talked about it, and she made it a reality. But she asked if I'd be interested in teaching a graduate and undergrad course looking at politics, economics, and social justice or social change. And she said this is an area where it hasn't been there's not much in this area. So she felt that in a way we could add to the academic rigor of the program as well as the institution, and also Appalachian Studies nationally, by bringing in this aspect of politics, economics, and social change, social justice. And so part of this course we're developing, it's brand new. It's not been taught anywhere that we know of, only at Shepherd here right now. And so I, instead of just having a lecture format that's many institutions have, I wanted to make it more of an Oxford, Cambridge style type of learning, which is more tutorial, more in the sense of discussion, reading, writing, discussion, and just really looking at digging deep into Appalachian studies, and particularly in the area of social change and social justice. And labor, of course, the labor movement is very rich in Appalachia. The movement and social change driving from that. I mean, everywhere from Blair Mountain, Mother Jones, it's very, very rich. And so one of the components of what we're going to be learning will be on labor, the labor movement, and social justice deriving from those movements. And that's why I wanted to invite you and JB to be part of it. And I extended an invitation out to Josh Sword with the AFL-CIO as president to get kind of a statewide, but more of a regional aspect. He could compare what's happening in other parts of the country and how it relates to Appalachia. Are there differences in the labor movement in these other regions? And what are those differences? So we're going to have that coming up on, is it the 19th? I got it. It's not this.
Yes. Yes. You've
yeah, I got the 19th.
Re-advised
yeah,
us.
Yes. Yeah. The 19th Tuesday.
Right.
At 6:30, because we meet on Tuesday evenings, but it's scheduled, and we want to invite the public. The idea there for the students are going to be conducting the meeting. So we, from 6:30 to about 7:30, we'll have, just kind of like a presentation, kind of a community discussion. Community is invited, the university. And then after about 7:30, 7:45, we'll take a break. And then you, John, and JB, and Josh, will go back to our classroom and just have really kind of a round table, one-on-one discussion with the students. So this gives the students an opportunity to put on a forum, conduct a forum, take question and answers, raise awareness, bring forward the ideas. So it gives them practice in doing that. And then afterwards, it gives them an opportunity to really have a sit down with the experts, with you all, and just kind of have a dialogue in what's all about, and also kind of have an exchange of the idea here is how they can be equipped to make the social changes that are necessary to make our community, our region, our country better. And so what I hope to get from the students get from this course is that not just me just professing or lecturing, but have a diversity of voices, of ideas, of concepts, but also looking at individuals, getting to talk to people who are out there actually making change. And you two definitely fit that model. And I wanted to kind of bring bring you all to them, and from your wealth of experience and trials and tribulations and knowledge of being out into the field and practitioners, I really wanted them to get to talk with you and draw from your experiences and your knowledge so that they can take those concepts and those ideas and those best practices and implement it in their own communities and as they move forward and continue to try to make our communities better. So that's the idea. And at the end of the course, at the end of the semester, I'm hoping that the students are inspired and that they have a knowledge base, an open mind, curiosity and inquisitive mind to ask questions and to raise awareness, but also be equipped with the tools and techniques and strategies and tactics that can really make a difference in their communities. And so that's the journey. So on the 19th, we're going to focus in on the labor, social justice, and social action. And like I said, I'd invite people to this event. It's going to be at 6:30. It'll be in the Bird Auditorium is where we're going to start. And then after that, we'll have question and answer with the community. And then once we adjourn that meeting, like I said, we'll proceed with just the students for the course to really kind of have a roundtable discussion of more in depth in what was discussed earlier. So I look forward to it. I tell you, it's a great course because I feel I'm a facilitator. You know, I know they call me professor but St. John's College in Annapolis takes this model where they read the great books and then they have dialogue and they call their instructors, not professors, but tutors. And I really like that because I see myself learning just as much as the students are in this course. We're all learning together and taking this journey, and I'm, hopefully I'll give them some advice and some experiences, but we're going to learn from others. And I learn from them as well, because they come with certain experiences and knowledge as well that's different from mine. So it's a unique course, and I intended for it to be that way. I'm having a lot of fun with it on Tuesday evenings, and I'm hoping Shepherd will continue this course in the future, but we'll see. It's really an experiment.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. One is Appalachia. Does it stretch all the way from Vermont to Arkansas? What are you talking about when you think Appalachia?
Well, I define the Appalachian region as what the Appalachian Regional Commission defines it. It goes all the way from Maine to Georgia, or stretches down through those states. And so if you look at the ARC, the Appalachian Regional Commission, it pretty much lays out that region, socioeconomic, type of setting. So as far as my definition of Appalachia, now, it's interesting, you pronounce it Appalachia. You can pronounce it Appalachia or Appalachian. What they always say is that south of the Mason-Dixon line, they refer to the region as Appalachia. Anywhere north of the Mason-Dixon line, it's Appalachia. Northern folks refer to it as Appalachia. Southern folks refer to it as Appalachia. But yeah, that's the region in which, at least I define it, as that socioeconomic region that's recognized by the federal government.
Well, I spent a lot of time in Vermont and Western Massachusetts, and basically all up and down the Connecticut River Valley with the electrical and machine workers. I have tried, and then since being in West Virginia down here since 2003, and then remembering my own family, my mother's family came from north of Beckley. You know, it seems when I go to the Canaan Valley, it seems like the same world. Okay. I mean, when my wife and I first visited over there, we said, gosh, this looks like Southern Vermont, you know, I mean, it really does. And they had the same kind of, leaf changing colors. Right. And in some case, the same amount of wood stoves, you know, kind of burning, you know, as the home heat. And, but, you know, once you got sort of out of the Canaan Valley, you know, the differences were fairly sharp too, in both culture and in the kinds of occupations and, you know, resources that were there. Vermont never had any, they had granite resources, okay, for a while, but it was never a resource rich state like West Virginia has been, okay, or some other states. So so the economies are not, they have a lot of differences to them. And I'm not, if you had to define the things that were similar besides the fact they're living around mountains, I would have a hard time defining a single thread. I think the southern section does have a more distinct, political character. I'm not sure why, but it seems to, probably just the history. When you think about Appalachian labor in the West Virginia and in Kentucky, and then you can't separate yourself from the culture of mining and natural resources. And not only that, the wealth that it creates. And that wealth drives the political economy of a state, or at least is a big influence on it, right? As it should be, in a way. That's not necessarily wrong, you know, that happens. Government, I think, should sort of shape its lives a little bit around, you know, what everybody is, you know, what's the work that everybody is, you're trying to get everybody to do? What's the work that they can do? And so I appreciate very much the theme of Apple, but I'm sort of thinking not so much in terms of what I learned in Vermont and more down in this region. So it seems to me that since I've been here, maybe it's just old age. You know, you try to summarize, you know, some themes of your life or the morality of you know, what you've been doing. And I remember, a mentor that I had in Massachusetts, and an old timer, a true Bolshevik, actually. And he was, first time I had a strike that in the shop that I was representing. And I'd been on one before in California, but, you know, I called him up and said, what do we do now? He says, there's two rules in a strike. And I said, well, what are they? And he says, two, one, find something for everybody to do. And two, don't leave anyone behind. And I think that those two rules, you know, need wider circulation as a theme for our movement, the labor movement, because when everybody goes off on their own and does their own thing, or a bunch of giant corporations are more powerful than governments, and everybody's, and it's still the ideology everywhere is individualism. The theme of not leaving people behind and finding work for everyone to do, useful work, trying to raise the standard of living if your labors are creating more than it costs you to produce them. Okay. So I don't know how that's the thematic interest that I kind of have. But there has to be a moral vision at some point that unites people, and that's what I'm reaching for. How do you, we have to have more unity at the end of the process than at the beginning, right? In order to move forward.
Yeah. So you, that's a good point. So the Appalachian Trail, I think, goes from Maine to Georgia, I think. But I know the ARC, the Appalachian Commission, they're more focused on the socioeconomic similarities. And they go from like southern New York all the way across the Mississippi. So that's primarily their focus. So culturally, it doesn't include Vermont and some of these other things. I mean, as far as socioeconomic aspects of it. But I think that this region really defined in different ways, what I have found has a lot of stereotypes or biases and has been traditionally an area that's been oppressed in a lot of ways in an economic and socioeconomic aspect, which, you know, a lot of the labor movement really got its birth from those. I mean, I'm thinking of people like Mother Jones and just the idea of coal mining and some of those aspects that really added to the labor movement overall, and not just for the region, but even for the country, and I'd say even internationally in some aspects of workers' rights, of safety, you know, workforce safety. A lot of these concerns had been.
Did he freeze up?
In the region, from the region itself, that translated into other types of context. And so that makes the region very rich in the labor movement and the idea of workers' rights, human rights, civil rights. You know, all these things were influenced from this region. And so, you know,
now you broke up a little bit there.
Of course, in the different states. Yeah, but there's a lot of similarities too.
Well, I know you have to leave us because you had another meeting coming up here. And then maybe just one final remark. Most of the labor movement's actual, you know, activity is usually related to a conflict over what share of the created wealth is going to be paid back in wages. And I mean, that drives the fundamental, the economic factors. Trade unions are an economic creation. They were something very, very different before the capitalist area, you know, came into being. So the economy, so raising incomes in proportion to wealth created is always going to be, the burning issue, independent of the morality of the thing. And the other aspect of the labor movement is that its only power is solidarity. It has no other power that amounts to anything. And that culturally is a very different kind of thing, you know, than what is the content of most media. it is. And, you know, so you're in a constant battle with, you know, if you don't love your neighbor, do you really love God? So that's so we're in a constant state of struggle. Well, you know, we can't be
theologically, there's no way of loving God without loving your neighbor. And really, I'd argue no way of really truly loving your neighbor without loving God. I mean, the two great commandments of love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. It's an and, not an or. And so you can't separate the two. So if you deceive yourself, if you say, oh, I love humanity, but you don't love God, and you deceive yourself saying, I love God, but I don't love my neighbor, it's a deception. It's not real. But you can't have the or. It's an and.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it's very simple. Very
simple. Hey, John.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you want us to do something there at Shepherd tonight as well?
No. Tonight, we had to move it because tonight is a different focus. Okay, yeah. Well, so no, it's just the 19th.
We have a union meeting on that same day that starts at 5:30 and normally ends at 6:30. So it's okay for us to come in a little bit late.
Yeah, that'll be fine.
Why don't we, John, why don't we figure out if we can actually get the meeting to take place down in Shepherdstown?
Well, let's talk about that later. Yeah, we'll look at that later.
Yeah, okay. All right, yeah. We can see if we can do it. Anyway, we'll work it out. Okay, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be good. Well, you all could have Josh over and, you know, if you had it close by.
Well, he would be an attraction, I think so. Yeah, so. Yeah.
I think it'd be good to have Josh at your meeting. But if it's close by, then all you had to do is transition.
Well, that's true.
From your all's meeting into the 6:30 forum. Yeah.
Well, right. I'll see if we can work with that. Yeah.
And we might be able to get Kenny Collinson on the board then too.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, if you all want to bring him, that's good. I just really wanted you. I mean, I wanted Josh, wanted you too. Kenny would be welcomed. Just to give that both that, you know, that national, state, local flavor, you know, and that's what you all bring. So yeah, bring Kenny.
It's so good to see you, John. John, you look great, and I'm so happy. Everything you're doing is fantastic. you know, I disagree with John on a lot of things about Appalachia and the way we pronounce it and that kind of stuff, but also the fact that we were a resource colony, you know, for 100 years, and how there was also you know, these companies running roughshod over the workers. You know, we have a history of that, that is not it's not something that we like to hold up, you know, as a shining example. You know, it's just the opposite of that. So but I really appreciate you doing this course. It sounds very interesting, and we're really looking forward to it.
Great. Yeah.
What?
All right. I know you got another meeting to go to.
All
right, so we're going to thank John Unger for joining us today for this segment of the Labor Beat Radio program, and we'll be we'll let you know where the podcast can be seen too, John. Anyway, so we're going to go forward here with a discussion of the bye-bye, John. Anyway, with the UAW strike, and hey, so JB, I got a I got a transcript of a few minutes of Sean Fain's basically address to the whole membership of the UAW, and then he made it public afterwards. So I'm going to play.
I watched it live on Facebook.
All right, so I'm going to play a couple of excerpts from that. Okay, excerpts, what do you call it? And then I'd like to get your reaction to it too when we do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me hold on a second. Let me get
it all queued up.
Well, I do. I do have it all queued up. I did have it all queued. There it is. Here we go.
We met with the company on Tuesday, so I wanted to take the opportunity to go through their proposal tonight with all of you. Just as a reminder, we are living in a golden era for the Big Three. Ford's revenue and profits are surging. Ford made over $10.4 billion in profits in 2022 and is on track to surpass that in 2023. Those are profits created by our hands, our dedication, and our sacrifice. And those profits have resulted in unparalleled gains for company executives and rich shareholders. In fact, Ford CEO Jim Farley has said that Ford is entering, quote, the most promising period for growth in Ford's history. So let's take a look at what Ford is proposing for their workers as the company moves forward into a new era of magnificence and splendor. First, we've demanded that temporary work be just that, temporary. Many of you have probably seen the video we made telling the story of Ford employee Sarah Chambers, a fourth-generation Ford worker and a single mother who started at Ford as a temporary worker and had to work for 16 years before reaching top pay. I want to take less than a minute to show you a quick clip from that video.
My grandfather worked at Ford. My great-grandfather was the first deaf man to be hired in at Ford Motor Company. He had 8 kids and provided for his family. And then my mother raised 5 kids, mostly on a single income until her older years. So all of those generations could do it on a single income because they had raises along the way that sustained the economy and the cost of living at that time. And somewhere in between, I think Ford, GM, and Chrysler, I think the employees got left behind.
So like Sarah, many of you know that my grandparents also were auto workers. In fact, I carry one of my grandfather's check stubs with me every day that I go to work. That generation was willing to uproot themselves from all corners of this country and move to the Midwest to take jobs at General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford, because that was what was understood to be a life-changing opportunity to earn a family-sustaining income. Sarah's experience is the exact opposite. Rather than receiving an income that can support her family, Sarah's had to live paycheck to paycheck during the company's most profitable decade in history. So Sarah's right. While the companies have succeeded, workers have been left behind.
That's right.
This race to the bottom has been driven in part by the reliance on an army of permatemps. These are workers who often work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, for months on end, with no commitment from the company to their future. That's why we have demanded an end to the use of permatemps with strong language that would require all temporary workers to be given the opportunity to convert to full-time seniority employment after 90 days. We've also demanded that temps be paid at not less than 85% the top rate, that they receive profit-sharing checks, that they be provided full health care and retirement benefits. Rather than agreeing to our common sense demand of equal pay for equal work, Ford has proposed that there be no cap on the use of temporary workers. The company has proposed that they receive less than 60% of the top wage rate, that they be denied a fair share of the profits that their labor produces, and they be given second-tier health care and no retirement benefits. Worse still, under Ford's proposal, the company would have the right to transition to an entirely temporary workforce over time, and we would have no say in this. So let me say that again. The company is proposing the unilateral right to hire as many temps as they want and keep everyone working as temps permanently with no end in sight. UAW family, that ain't happening. We're going to continue to fight to make sure that temporary workers don't become a growing underclass of workers at the big three, and we're going to win that fight. You know, my grandparents' generation, the generation that founded our great union, they also knew that while the bosses and politicians love to give lip service to the value of hard work, they only put their money where their mouth is when they're forced to. Today, we are once again living in a time of great inequality. The rich are getting richer while the rest of us are getting left behind. It's up to us once again to turn the tide against corporate greed by demanding labor's share of the value that we produce. That's why we went to Ford and proposed a double-digit wage increase, just like the big three CEOs have received over the last 4 years, because we know our members are worth the same and more. We also have a lot to make up for in inflation-adjusted dollars. Our starting pay today is $10 an hour less than it was in 2007, 16 years ago. So we've demanded the reinstatement of cost of living adjustments to protect our future and our families against a relentless tide of inflation. What has Ford proposed? A 9% general wage increase over the life of the contract.
That's ridiculous.
Instead of cost of living, they've offered one-time lump sum bonuses.
Companies I like this guy, John.
Bonuses because they keep their base wages low, reducing.
I like this guy. He's so to the point.
Not only fail to meet our needs.
Well, you know, we're getting a flavor here of his approach.
He's awesome.
Edit out that part where I couldn't find it.
But, I like this guy. Right. This guy is practical. You know, he's hitting them right in the heart. You know, everything he says is true. You know.
Well, my question really that I wanted to talk about this is that it looks to me like the chances of a strike are now way north of 50-50, you know. So, and that's going to, if he takes on all three of the companies, it's going to be brutal, okay? And so my question really is that what are we going to have to do locally and regionally to help support this? Because it's if they take it on like this, they can't lose. They got to win. And it's, you know, the latest figures on union participation or representation in the country are now at 7%. You know, so we're talking about in the public, most of the public doesn't even know what a union is, really. And so how the interests of auto workers are, you know, what happens to them is what's going to happen to you, right? That's, and how do we get that message? How does that message get a little bit more circulation? That was what really I was thinking about. Got any ideas, pal?
I'm sorry. I was distracted.
No, not again.
could you summarize that, please?
Yeah. Now my question is how are we going to do solidarity efforts? Cause these guys, if they take on the whole big three at once, which looks like what's happening here, then that's going to be you're going to have to win that in the court of public opinion, not just on the picket line. So
they have everything in their favor. I think the union is leveraged. You know, I think they have leverage over the company because of the bottom line. You know, the cars, the electric cars coming out, the fact that the prices keep going up, the fact that the CEO's pay goes up, and you know,
yeah, no, I mean, it's,
they have a great argument. And how is Ford, GM, and Chrysler going to make cars without the workers that make the goddamn cars? They're not going to do
on
it.
On the other hand, the auto industry is like a final output stream for a whole bunch of other industries that make all the parts and that you know, sell the fuels and all the other stuff, you know, right, for these cars. So a strike that goes more than, I don't know, a few weeks is likely going to cause some serious economic damage, at which point, you know, the public opinion stakes in the issues you know, that the union is involved in become pretty important, you know, to spell out. So that's what crossed my mind. How do we spread support for the auto workers if they take this on, which it looks like they're going to? So what do you think?
God, you know, it's hard to do a show when you're getting text messages.
Well, just put your text messages down.
But I really think this is huge, John, and I can't say enough about where we are today as opposed to where we were 5 years ago. You know, I really think it's a change, and it's a change for the better. It's a positive change. You know, there's more transparency. There, you know, people are getting wise to what's going on more than they ever have. And that gives me hope. You know, that gives me hope that workers will finally, you know, have a decent wage and have a decent future, that they don't have to, you know, sweat out these temporary workers and all this bullshit that they put out, you know, with the companies. And I just welcome it, you know, with both arms. And I'm excited about the future of labor.
It'd be good if we had a way to get a little bit more press. You know,
we have to have our own press, John, you know.
Yeah, well, we have to be able to be ready.
Well, yeah, we have to have labor TV and start out like at Free Speech TV and Link TV, all these independent broadcasters that don't have corporate sponsors. You know, they are self-funded, and that's how you start. And then, you know, you can work in some products that have the same philosophy, you know, where they share the wealth and you know, good businesses and good products that, you know, have that philosophy about sharing the wealth. And there's, I think it can happen, but I agree. I think we need to get more press, and we need to do a better job of educating the public and getting these courses, like what John's teaching at Shepherd, get them out in the mainstream, you know, get some interest in it and show the parallels between Appalachia and the resource colony of what it was 100 years ago, and how they organized and how the companies tried to separate the different groups, you know, the blacks against the, you know, Hispanics, and the Hispanics against the Polish folks, and, you know, all the different nationalities. You know, the corporations did their best to keep them separate so they wouldn't organize.
Right.
And now we've beaten that, you know, we're above that. We all get together. We, you know, for the most part, I mean, we have our ups and downs, but for more now than ever, we have honesty in how people treat each other. And, you know, we've, you know, the term racist was never used very often in the past. Now you hear it all the time. Nazis, you know, we never talked about Nazis. Hell, we got Nazis that were in the White House. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, we've come so far, John. And, you know,
Have we come so far forward or so far backward? I can't tell whether you're saying it's forward or backward.
No, I think it's forward. I think it's good.
Because we have more Nazis now. I mean, what?
No, I mean, they're exposed. Before, they were hidden. You know, they were hidden under the surface, and they had all these buzzwords, and they had all these secret handshakes and all this stuff. And all that stuff is gone now. Now they're out in the open. I think they were smaller.
I think they're bigger now. I don't think you're right.
Well, they're going to jail, John. They're going to jail, and they're not going to get pardoned. You know, Trump is going to go away. His stock value for Truth Social is down to $14 a share from 175. So it's taken a huge dive, and all this shit's just going to go away. You know, it'll be swept back under the rug where it belongs. And hopefully people will become enlightened by all this and change. You know, my sister.
Well, in the meantime, in the meantime, while all this great stuff is kind of happening, we're going to have to win this strike. Okay.
I think we can win the strike.
And I think it's got to be, I think we need to get our feet on the ground about that, not just spread horseshit around. Okay.
I think it's going to be a short empty strike. Talk.
You never know that, you know, and you never should plan on that. If you're going to plan on a short strike, the company will lock you up for one day longer. You know, you got to be prepared to take it to win. You know, there's we're going to show that we can do it. I mean, you know, you never, if they decide that they don't want to do what you're going to do. And for example, the proposals that he laid out that Ford's putting on the table, those proposals are intended to provoke. You know, that means that the company thinks that the union's proposals, or is trying to say that the union's proposals, are the exact just as ridiculous on the other side as our proposals are on this side. See, you know,
that's why you negotiate. That's where you come in the middle.
Well, that's not the way most big negotiations go, my friend. I mean, yeah, you know, if you have everybody go to the bar on both sides and drink up the night before, yeah, that's what'll happen. Okay. But most big time negotiations don't do that. Okay. And this one is, which means that they are actually not just rhetorically far apart. And so I think, and otherwise, there would be no reason for him to publicize the status of the negotiation at this point, unless he actually thought that as well. So anyway, well, I think
maybe I'm naive about it, but I.
Well, I yes, see. No, it's a serious, a very serious fight coming up if they walk out. Okay, and it's going to put the whole labor movement at stake. As it should, everybody's ready for it. Like you say, it's been building. People are more prepared. They're ready to fight. Yes. So they're going to have to, you know.
Right. I mean, this is our time.
Everybody joins the army, John. But.
Huh?
Yeah. Anyway.
This is our time. And I think
we got to win it.
We're going to come out ahead.
All right. All right. Well, we'll figure out how to do that next session. All right. I think we're done for today. Anyway, thanks. Thanks for joining in.
Okay, John, it was a great show. I appreciate it. I appreciate you doing all the work.
No, that's okay.
A lot of work. It's a lot of work you do over there.
Got to keep it going.